Thank you very much for this opportunity to present some of the work which has been done by a very active periods and not so active other periods group under Lieber addressing these kind of questions. People who know me know that this is torture for me, not speaking, but having to stand still. Normally I run around here, but I will try. But if you sort of see me sort of jumping around, that's because I'm normally actually trying to articulate what I'm saying. I think this talk to some extent reflects one of the things which I was taught when I was young, and that is that you have to hear things several times. The first time you just listen, the second time you start to believe it, and the third time, I mean, you do believe it, even though you may not understand it fully. I'm not sure we all understand the implications of the digitization which we are entering right now. I think we have ideas, and what I'm going to talk about, following what Michael said earlier, what Stefan said, is really some issues around data and data. You might call it data and publications or data-stimulated publications. Stefan has already highlighted some of the reasons why we have to address these issues. Libraries need to redefine their role. And those of you who have read Steve Jobs' book actually understand fully the notion of having to redefine your activity. I mean, you can't keep on saying you are handling over books. Newspapers did that a long time ago. There had to be more than publishing newspapers. They had to distribute news. So by actually just that simple rephrasing, suddenly new opportunities were quite clear for the people. I think the same is happening right now for the libraries. And there are different routes which are taken by different libraries, of course, depending on your mandate. Some of the public libraries convert themselves into service centers. Some of the research libraries convert themselves into IT centers combined with some information provision. And others look at new opportunities. So we have these different roads. What I'll be focusing on is really the latter, about the new possibilities, the new services which libraries might offer to their patrons, this being both students and researchers. And what I'm going to use as a background for my talk is really some activities which has been happening in as part of Lieber. Lieber has initiated work around e-science, primary data, workflows, virtual research environments, etc., etc. And about 2 years ago, it actually started a group asking them to come up with ideas about how libraries could respond to these challenges. And I've highlighted, we read some of these things which we have been focusing on, which is identifying the opportunities for research libraries. What are the new opportunities in this digital age? How can we actually go in and be closer and help with stimulating our users to use this information infrastructure? We have also been asked to address the issues about skills. I mean, what are actually the future skills needed in order to satisfy this? And of course, I mean, here is a link, because you first have to identify the potential roles before you actually can identify the potential skills. So we started out with identifying the roles. The group members is Mark, who is sitting over there, Rob Grimm, who is probably here in the audience somewhere, Wolfram Horstmann, who also is here, Annika Ross, Tom Pollack, Daphne Jansen, and myself. So this is the small group which actually has come up with a lot of the stuff, and I thank them for actually providing a lot of the information which I'm going to share with you for the next few, 20 minutes. So after this short introduction, I'm going to give you the outline of my talk, and it actually just has two sort of whole area or two areas. One is, is some thoughts about the data-driven communication, and this links very much to what Stefan has been talking about already. I'm going to talk about it slightly differently. And I was sitting during the talk and thinking whether I could take up this metaphor from physics about entropy and maybe, being from Copenhagen, talk about the Copenhagen duality, because I'm actually addressing it more from the user point of view, where Stefan actually was addressing it, in a sense, from the system point of view. What is the infrastructure which drives this? Well, I'm not sure I can actually carry out that analogy, so I'm not going to do it. And the other half of the talk is going to be the potential roles of the libraries, and which reflects very much on the work which has been done by the group. It will draw upon two workshops we have had, and in those workshops we have had presentations from Dataverse, which is an infrastructure to support data. We have had the Alliance from Permanent Access talking about the infrastructure, the digital preservation activities. We have had DataSite talking about the naming of research data. We have talked about the linked data, the semantic infrastructure, which also was touched upon by Stefan. And we have talked about the Open Data Foundation, which in a sense addresses also the question which was there. I mean, the attempt to try to keep an openness about the activities which is required in order to create this huge infrastructure. And some of the things has been very much from, as I said, a user point of view, and a lot of it also has been quite technical, trying to identify what are the technicalities which we actually need to understand. And I've just illustrated here with a cube, and I'm not going very much into the technical details, but the cube has some of the terms which are required, like the OWL, like the RDF, like the UIR, and I'll come back to some of this. So in a sense, you might say this is the introduction to some, to my second half of my talk. For the first half, I'm going to talk a bit about data and data-driven publications. And the first thing you might ask, what is data? And I think there's a huge discrepancy between what people actually mean by data. I was looking up different definitions, and I found, I think, more than 10 different definitions, and they did not all agree. Data for me is, in a sense, everything which is being processed in order to stimulate or is behind an argument. So data, it may be words, because words might be analyzed. Clarin is an example of research infrastructure based on words. It may be numbers, that's what we normally think about, numbers coming out from experiments, numbers coming out from observations, numbers coming out from questionnaires. It might be symbols, like music, like notes, like paintings, like icons. So there's a lot of different things which is data. And therefore, talking about the whole interoperability between data, I think, is extremely ambitious. And I think, to some extent, the reason the semantic web did not take off in the late 90s when Tim Berners-Lee first talked about it was, in a sense, that he was too ambitious. He tried to solve everything at once. And I think what we are seeing now is that this structure is emerging in different subjects. And I'm sure that in the end, everything will actually go together, come together, and form a big sort of knowledge infrastructure. I've just here quoted one of the one of the definitions, one which I like quite a bit, which says the research data means data in the form of facts, observation, images, computer program results, records, measurements, or experiments on which an argument, theory, test, or hypothesis, or another research output is based. So that's what I really mean about the data. But the data in itself is really nothing had it not been because of the hypothesis, had it not been because of the rendering, had it not been because of what is actually being done with it. Data in itself is, I won't say meaningless. They are not meaningless. They contain a lot of information, but they need to be interpreted somehow. So data is a seat of a process. And what is the end result then at the moment very much is often an article, a picture, a piece of music, some interviews. Just to give you an idea, I mean, try to illustrate some of the points I think also which is behind the data-rich publications, you might say, except that when I say it, I mean it's slightly different than when Stefan was saying it. If you have data and you do some rendering, this is an example, this is a map, this is a normal map as I would take it and walk around with it in the forest. This is, of course, is based on observations, what kind of trees, what is the nature. But there's also, I could have this different map here. This looks slightly different from what you are normally used to see, but actually what this illustrates is how easy it is to go from A to B. So this is the kind of map which is used by orienteering people who need to run from A to B. I can tell you, it can also be used to find out where you can find very good patches of blackberries and things like that, because I mean those things are very difficult to run through, so these are actually marked as difficult pieces. But I can assure you the nature is exactly the same, but these are two different interpretations of the same kind of data, but with two different purposes. And what we see at the moment in a lot of articles is one rendering, which could just as well have been a different rendering for a different purpose. And it's one of the issues which is needed in order for really reuse the data is access to the original data rather than just access to the rendering, to the article, etc., etc. So this is one example where you start out with data, you do something, you publish that, you share that, but that is only a fraction, it only has a fraction of the information which actually is behind it, because what you do is a rendering. You can illustrate also the limitation which is in a picture by a different means. Here we have a picture. If we drill in on it, there is a limited number of information. There's a limited amount of information in this picture. If you drill in, you don't get any higher resolution on this part. In contrast, so if you had a map in a database, when you actually start to drill in, your results become richer and richer, and you can actually get more and more information as you drill in. So these are two different examples of how you can publish. You can publish in a way so you have a limited amount of information, you can do nothing, or you can publish in a way so you actually can drill in. Ideally, of course, one should also be able to drill in and get sort of back to the original data, but that's a different story. Now, this about information and how information can be processed also has implications for how you can do research. And it's quite interesting. The first time I actually, this is a figure which I saw the first time in 2007 in Tilburg. And it was John Wilbanks who showed this figure. And it really was an eye-opener for me. Because what is shown here on the figure is sort of the exponentially growing part of the figure is the amount of money put into a very specific area. And I can tell you that the number of articles published within that area also grows exponentially. But what the red curve is showing is actually, in a sense, the number of entries, meaning, in a sense, the number of patterns, the number of... it's a way of trying to measure the number of results coming out of this research. And the point he was making was that actually the knowledge coming out from the huge amount of information which is actually created right now is not really growing exponentially as one would think. And one of the theories he made was that this was actually because the way we handled these publications... What we did was we published something, we read it, we tried to understand it, and we could do nothing more. And for a very long time, I thought that he was the only one who was thinking that, and I was the only one thinking this was a fantastic idea. But then, it has sort of started to come up. And there was an article in Nature called Speed Reading, where they actually were talking about researchers struggling to try to make sense of the immensely increasing number of articles out there. And it really comes back then to the semantic enriched article which Stefan was talking about. Because what really, I mean, the point which was made here was you somehow need to decompose the article so that you can use computers to really, I mean, in a sense, pre-digest them for you so that you can ask the computer to make some analysis. And there's been a long discussion about how that can be done. And the nanopublications, which was mentioned by Stefan, could be one way. There might be others. Another thing which comes out and which was also illustrated by Stefan, now this is a different kind of example, I'll have one which corresponds to Stefan, is the thing that if you have things in here represented in a more rich manner, for instance, if you have a molecule represented through the bondings, you might actually both have the 2D version, you might have 3D version, you might turn it around. In contrast to the normal PDF version of the article, where you just have the graph with a limited amount of information, which I showed you with the picture where when I go in, I got no more information. So this also is a way, and this is coming for researchers really, I mean, starting now to come with different kinds of requirements. So what we see here, I think, is the starting of a new paradigm for research communication infrastructure, which is based on data. Another example, which I mean is directly related to the thing which Stefan showed, is you might actually have an article and you can develop tools so that you can, as Stefan showed, I mean, highlight different things, or you actually might, I mean, look into databases which has the different kinds of information and you might expand the information. This information need not all be integrated as part of this article. And I think this is really the kind of development which we are seeing right now is that the information becomes available through the linked open data metaphor, and you can certainly try to actually enrich your publication drawing in data from different kinds of sources, as was also showed by Stefan. So this is the kind of stuff which is happening right now. And what, in a sense, I mean, I have now two slides trying to put this in perspective, because it's always easy once you sit there and have seen what's happening to try to see, I mean, make theories about, I mean, what is it you actually are seeing. But I mean, this is quite interesting because this again is a graph. I mean, this is again a graph from 2007, and one of the things which is illustrated on this graph is really, I mean, the development of development of structure. What is shown on one axis here is the semantic of the information, and what is shown on the other graph is actually the social interaction. If you want to do research, you both need the information and you need the social interaction. Now, what's shown here is it's not like a graph where you sort of say, I mean, this value against this value. It's sort of an illustration. But it's an illustration about what is actually happening in the digital age, where we start with the PC era, we got the simple web, and where we are now developing. The first thing which happened was that we got to the Web 2.0. Instead of this the web just being information, we started to get the social involvement. We started to involve people. Instead of just, I mean, getting information out, we actually started to stimulate a dialogue. We supported different kinds of fora so people could communicate. I mean, it really was sort of, in a sense, the start of the dialogue. And what we are seeing right now is what's sometimes it's called the Web 3.0, where we start to introduce structure, semantics, and where we both, I normally say that, I mean, Web 3.0 is very interesting from a librarian point of view, because it actually starts to draw on the things which I've been told librarians were taught when they went to library school, and that is the importance of authority. It really draws upon authority files, because we need to have exact information in order to be able to build the infrastructures which Stefan showed and I illustrated just before. At the same time, people don't trust authorities as much as they used to do. So we also need to build up structures so that people feel they can influence. I mean, Wikipedia is a very good example, but there are a lot of other examples where you actually involve people. It's shown that students trust other students more than they trust authorities, and somehow we need to build up systems so that we stimulate that. I mean, I don't think we can fight it, so what the best we can do is actually to come in and see how we can help and how we can stimulate and maybe how we can put knowledge into this. So this is something which is happening right now. Another way of illustrating this is I tried to see if I could find this on the web. Unfortunately, I've not been able to. But it was a talk I heard by Mark Kornbluh, and he was talking about the how technological changes happened. And he talked about three phases when you see a technological change. If you have a new technology coming in, like the digitization, like the computers, the first thing which happens is that you apply the new technology. So what you do is you actually keep your existing processes. You do the same, just a bit faster. An example could be, we have the analog book, we digitize them, but we still serve them as books. We can do it, the delivery is a bit faster, the logistics behind is a bit faster, but basically the book is like the analog, as Stefan also was saying. The next thing we do is we start to integrate these things. We are seeing now that information is being integrated into learning management systems. We are developing virtual research environments where we start to integrate these different components. But we are still sort of struggling, and we are still sort of, in a sense, slightly in the analog, because we are still using the PDF as our master format. It's not the enriched publication which is our master format. It's not the XML which is our master format, or the data sets together with the programs. It's not the normal thing. It may never be so. I think it will, because once we get this data structure, things will change totally. And that means that what I think we are at now is really at the second stage in the development. And we are now entering, maybe, the third phase, which is the infusion, diffusion, where we don't think about this as being something special. We don't think of the digital book as being a special thing. It is just a matter of, that's what it is. And it becomes an integrated part of our life where we actually use it, reuse it, make new products, tools, support, we are making new products. It becomes really an integrated. That's where we have the infrastructure totally in place and where we really don't think about it. You don't think about use of electricity, but there was a period where it was really, a huge thing to actually make it run, and now it's a commodity. And I think information is going to be the same once we get this infusion. So I think we are sort of in here. And now I come to my second half of my talk, which is, the library response to this activity. So we have, as I said earlier, the LibreE Scholarship Working Group. And the approach we took to trying to come up with recommendations for libraries how they should actually respond to this development was to arrange a number of workshops. And we have had two workshops, and we are going to plan a third one, which is going to be in association with the Libre conference in June. And the first two was really about good practices around service models, how we could work together. The second was about data reuse, how metadata could actually stimulate the reuse of data. The approach we also took was that there was a lot of talk. And I mean, you just have to look at any announcement or conferences to see that. I mean, for instance, when we had our conference in December, there were three competing conferences all about data. So, I mean, data really, I think, is seen by many as the sort of the straw which we all sort of hold onto in order to see our own survival. Data, it may be one part, but I'm not sure. I mean, I'm absolutely sure it's not going to be the only part. But a lot of things is happening around data. So what we wanted was, we wanted to have people involved who actually had some practical experience. And what I'm going to show you now are a few of the examples and what we learned during those two workshops. One which I think very much is a natural evolution is the DRIAD project, which looked at how you actually could link journals to articles, so that once you had a journal, you knew which articles was once you had a journal article, you knew which data it was based on, and once you had the data, you actually knew which journal articles came out of those data. And they were starting up in a subject area. And trying to identify what the library role in this sort of creating this infrastructure could be. I mean, one thing which came out quite often was the library has a brand. And we can use that brand to actually position ourselves to be the safe haven of the data. So it really is very much about long-term stability, commitment, and security. In other words, ensuring the long-term access to these data. Another thing which came out and also came out in a number of the other presentations we had was that the library really can serve as a hub for communication. Libraries can be a mediator between different stakeholders. Libraries can be a mediator between different research groups. One of the things which is required in order for this infrastructure to be operational is that you need an URI, you need a unique identifier. And therefore, we also had DataCite in actually in both our workshops. DataCite is interesting because they're trying to promote the use of a DOI. So what they've done is they've actually negotiated business deals so it is possible to use a DOI. Because, I mean, earlier it was simply too expensive. But they are also building services based on the DOIs. So they are standardizing how you create your metadata. And because you have standardized the way you create your metadata, you can build services. Just as was shown in Stefan's talk about the links where you operate on the data. I mean, here you can go in and search on different different research data which addresses specific issues. Another presentation, because one thing is to be able to cite the data. You also need to have the data somewhere. And there we had a presentation of the Dataverse infrastructure, which is open source. You can all use it. Many of you are using it already. And I think what's important there is, again, that it actually stimulates the fact that libraries might offer a safe haven for the data. Libraries trust, we are trusted by our scholars to do a good job. I mean, it may be a false security for them, because the fact that we have been able to save books for 500 years does not mean that we actually can save the bits and bytes for 10 years. But at least, we still have the brand, and I think our opportunity is to nourish that brand and ensure that we actually can accomplish this job. A lot of stuff which comes up again and again is standards. And standards is the way that everything becomes interoperable. Another... I talked earlier about the linked data. Again, it's about integration, about linking, about reuse. And there we had a presentation by David Reynolds, who actually gave a very nice example of how one could use linked data to give different kind of services. I mean, he presented this in a very nice way and also presenting all the information lying below it. But basically, you have a number of... if this one can be used. Well, you can see the yellow and the red dots. I mean, there you have different kinds of measurements, which goes into a central database. And you can do different kind of analysis based on those data. And the thing is that the data comes in with one purpose, but it can be reused for different kind of purposes. So you might actually want to go in and get detailed scientific information about the water pollution, the temperature, etc., for scientific purposes. But you might also want, as a human being, to find out whether it's worth going to that beach, or, I mean, how the situation is. Is the blue flag up, or is there pollution? What is the water temperature, and things like that. And I think a lot of, it shows, and I mean, this is an example, that once you have data and you have it properly structured, data can be reused. And I think one of the issues which is very important is the reuse of data, because that's a way of actually also, you may say, save money in the long run. I mean, instead of doing experiments over and over again, we might reuse data from others. But that also requires us to be open about it. Just to give you a, sort of an indication of what's behind the semantic web, I mean, this is a drawing which is quite often made, where you have the identifier, the unique identifier, and the way you actually encode your letters, Unicode, in the bottom. And then you have different layers of structure which you add up. And if you try to look at potential roles of libraries, we can't be everywhere. And one of the things which came up over and over again is we need partnerships. But there are a number of places where we are more naturally located than others. We could be running the unique identifier server. We could be running knowledge about how you build ontologies, that is the language which you use to describe these things. We could build up information about researchers, their identifiers. We could stand for trust, for authentication, for authorization, for access. So there are a number of potential roles, but I think it's important that we don't try to do everything, but that you just, I mean, you have to limit yourself. Jumping back a bit, this should have been before this one, is we also talked a lot about the openness. And we had a presentation by Rob Grimm about the Open Data Foundation. I think what's extremely important is the openness of data. And what the Open Data Foundation is about, it's a non-profit organization promoting the adoption of a global metadata standard and the development of open source solutions for the management and use of, in this case, statistical data, but it should apply for all kinds of data. I mean, the open access movement came after the fact, after articles had been out there for a long time. I think we have a chance about data before the journals capitalize them and make them part of their assets. I see examples are being made now. Nature was the first because there was some fraud, and they want to avoid that. I have full understanding of it, but I think it's important that we keep, or not we, but our research community keep the rights over the data so they can make them openly available as a part of a data infrastructure. The Alliance for Permanent Access was there presenting both Riding the Wave vision and giving different kinds of views upon how you actually can do the digital preservation, how you, as part of your collection, you actually start collecting relevant context information. I mean, Stephen was again saying context as sort of the ultimate way we get over. Context is king. We need the context in which data is created. We need to know what instrument was used, what methodology was used, what the climate situation was, if it was an Earth observation. We need to know what kind of profiling has been done with the experiment in order to be able to reuse and trust the data in the future. So all of this is extremely important that we collect this as in part. And this somehow should be referenced from the data set as well. And now we start to see that data becomes extremely complicated because not only do we have to have an information about how the data itself is structured, but we also need to know all the information which is required in order to understand the validity of the data in question, else no other group will ever reuse them. So, Kevin Ashley from the Digital Curation Center gave a very nice summary of what the libraries actually could do in this collection with the data. And again, it's very much about trying to capitalize on the skills we have. So it's continue to provide selection and access to data. It is leadership. It is services and try to get close to the research groups. It is responsibility to coordinate actions around data management, and it could be about auditing and ensure the awareness of what needs to be preserved and to understand the data management landscape. He also gave a very nice illustration of how these different activities fit into the DCC curation lifecycle model, where the library could come in: leadership, policy, planning, the audit engagement, etc., etc. So there are a lot of different roles one can take. Again, I think the idea is we have to be careful not to try to solve everything in every little library. We have to partner up, we have to share, we have to focus. So even the libraries in the future become more specialized in a sense because we can't do everything. I mean, this is a little graph trying to summarize some of the stuff which has been said. Here, on the up, we have the amount of information, the amount of data. This could be measured in petabytes. And then you also have the time. And I think what's happening is that in the beginning, actually before we begin, we can go out and help our researchers writing applications, writing management plans. Once the work is in progress, we might provide something database, others, ensure the good data practice, advising on tools, maybe in collaboration with others. But I think once the work is over, once the experiment is over, I think data gets into a second phase where it mainly is maintained but actively used. But there needs to be some appraisal. And at one of the workshops, there was actually a very nice idea about taking over the 5-star approach of the linked open data, that the data set might actually get some stars depending on how well described the data set is. And it might be a way of saying, I mean, we only preserve 5-star data sets. So this is not a question of the quality of the data set, but it's a question of the quality of the annotation of the data set, which is really king for the reuse of the data. And then the data go into the long tail, permanent access, where digital preservation and provision of access is one of the key issues. So, in the LIBA group, we have tried to identify different kind of roles and to see where it's a match between the data, the roles required in the data, and the libraries. And, I mean, here they are actually prioritized internally in the group, but we are going to have a meeting on Thursday, and you are all invited to be part of that if you want to, and you might actually influence how we do this, or you might actually come and talk to one of us. But ensure permanent access seems to be on top of our list, alone or in collaboration with data centers. Liaise and partner with data archives and data centers to foster a network and of interoperable infrastructure for data access, discovery, and data sharing was the second. The third was to cooperate with IT to offer secure dynamic storage. The fourth came in as offer data management infrastructure pages, which means that you might go out and teach the researcher what to do, but you might also offer online information, as for instance DISC has been developing online information systems so researchers know what they should do, what to put into their data management plan. Offer persistent identifiers, as for instance DataSite is doing. Develop data management procedures for local research groups. Assist researchers with grant applications that involve data management. And there are more, but these are sort of just the top. So, as I said, we are going to have a meeting on Thursday trying to come up with a list of recommendations which can be presented to LIBER. And if some of you have time, you are welcome to come Thursday afternoon. And else I will say thank you and open up for questions.